The book of Genesis, the first book in the Bible, has 50 chapters. And this evening I'd like to read with you, as we begin, the last of those, chapter 50 of the book of Genesis. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed, and the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Now when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am dying. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back.' And Pharaoh said, 'Go up and bury your father, and as he made you swear.' So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. Then they came to the threshing floor of Aten, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father, and when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Aten, they said, 'This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians.' Therefore its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who went up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him.' So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, 'Before your father died, he commanded, saying, Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, who were brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, 'I am dying. But God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.' And then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here.' So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him. And he was put in a coffin in Egypt." As I mentioned, the book of Genesis has 50 chapters. And it cuts quite an arc of the entire Old Testament history in that we begin the book with nothing. and end with Egyptian civilization. And so a lot of time and things have taken place in the interim between Genesis 1 and Genesis chapter 50. Of the 50 chapters, a great many of them deal with this one story. It starts in the 37th chapter, the story of Joseph. And one might think that this story would have so little to do with what we need to know from the Old Testament for the purposes it serves. The primary purpose of the Old Testament during the New Testament era, as described from Matthew through Revelation, is the usage of Old Testament prophecies fulfilled in the coming Messiah and his kingdom. But aside from those prophecies, as we've seen before, there are a number of lessons we learn from the principles laid down and the people who lived them out. And this story of Joseph is a case in point. It is true there is much to be made from the fact that Joseph is of the right family. He comes, of course, from Jacob or Israel. He is the beginning of what would seem to be, from human perspective anyway, the answer to God's promise to Abraham and Sarah. At that time, they're Abram and Sarai. When God first made the promise to them about a child and then about the multitude of their descendants being like the stars of the heavens or the sand on the seashore, it would seem when God made the promise and even after the giving of Isaac in the promise that promise was a little bigger perhaps than God could fulfill. And Isaac just has the two boys. Well, as it turns out, God just needed one of them to keep his promise. And then through Jacob, known as Israel, we have the children of Israel, the 12 tribes that come. And these are those that are described as the brothers of Joseph. And so from that, we have all we see later in terms of the nation of Israel and the Jewish religion itself. And so God's promise is seen in Isaac, and then Jacob, and then, of course, through Judah and following forward in the promises God had made. Joseph, his story, he's in there. He's an ancillary part of that prophetic story of Jesus and the promises made about him, but he's to the side somewhat from the direct line. And so what's the purpose of Joseph's story to begin with? And we might say, if we didn't know any better, that, well, it's an interesting story. But it takes a lot of space in this book. And by the way, God just doesn't give us interesting stories for the sake of entertaining us. There is some reason why this takes up such amount of space in the first book of the law, the first book of the Bible, for that matter. And that is, we have here described for us one of the principles of heaven that plays out time and time again amongst God's people. And it is coming to fruition here at the end of this book of Genesis in chapter 50. Like I say, we started the story in chapter 37, if we had been reading the story, which we haven't. But if we had, we'd have started in chapter 37. And Joseph, as just a young man, has had some dreams that upset his brothers that end up do coming true after the time has passed. But they are incensed by their father's favoritism for him. And they want to kill him, but they are kept from that by the oldest brother. And instead they dig a pit and put him in. And long story short, he's in Egyptian bondage. And there he languishes for years and for decades, it seems. And as we see here, he finally ends his life in that foreign land, far from his homeland. And at the time these things are beginning to play out, it would seem as if God had turned his back on Joseph. But of course we know we have the wonderful luxury of seeing the whole story, the beginning and the middle and the ending. And we can see what the wise man Solomon meant when he said, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. In so many cases, that is the case, especially when God has a part in it. Because the end of this long and seemingly sordid story, Joseph finally says the truth to his brothers that they didn't know. Joseph by this time surely did know, and God knew all along. And that is, as for you, he says to his brothers, you meant evil against me. Well, that's true. They knew that. That's why they were saying what they were saying and were afraid as they were afraid. As for you, you meant evil against me. But God meant it for good to save much people alive. And so for just a few moments, we won't spend long this evening in the lesson, but just very quickly, I'd like to look with you at three aspects of this. First, God's part in the whole matter, which is the most important thing. But then also briefly at the brothers. And then finally at Joseph himself. First, we see what God's hand does in all of this. The song hadn't been written yet, so it couldn't have been Joseph's favorite. But if it had been, I think it would have been. God moves in a mysterious way, His wonders to perform. Because God did move in a mysterious way in the life of Joseph. When it seems all the way along, bad things continue to pile on top of bad things, and calamity upon calamity. And every time, and you know the story, so we won't belabor time with describing the details of it, but you know that every time he seems to barely lift his head above the waters of difficulty, his head shoved underwater one more time. And then he, like cream rising to the top, or like a bobber in the water, he comes back up, and what happens? He's shoved back down again. And it would seem time and time again that Joseph is just one of those sad figures in history that can't get anything right or have anything good going in his favor. He's kind of the born loser, it seems, for some time. I remember a cartoon of Calvin and Hobbes that's always stayed with me, where he said, I don't mind that life is unfair. He said, just once in a while I'd like it to be unfair in my favor. Well, usually when we're talking about unfairness, we mean against us. Those who have life unfair in their favor, they just say, well, I deserve it. Joseph must have felt like he was in the bad end of a bad life for so long until he was able to do something that we're graced to be able to see him do. He's able to look back on this long life now lived and realize God's plan was at work all the way through. God knew what he was doing. And no doubt Joseph would have said, I didn't know what God was doing, but God knew what he was doing. And it played out in the story before us, because this nation that God was helping to survive and thrive, from which the promised Messiah would one day come, then this nation that was about to end their existence with starvation in the drought were saved as a people by this very Joseph, who decades before had been sold into slavery and had such a difficult life years before. So yes, God had a plan. Now we might think, well, wouldn't it be nice if God had told Joseph from day one, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and hang on, it's going to get worse, but I'm going to do this, and after a while, oh, you'll like what I'm going to do after that. But no, Joseph, like Job, and like so many others, and like so many of us, had to realize that God doesn't owe us explanations. And we might like for him to tell us things that we don't know, but probably we're better off not knowing what God does and we don't. But just the one thing that God does expect of us is not an understanding of his plan from day one, but trust in his plan from day one. Because God does have our best interests at heart. He did Joseph and his family and this nation. But then to his brothers. One thing I think we seldom point out about the brothers is the weight of wrongdoing over time. Now, their wrong against Joseph had been compounded by their lie to their father about what had happened to Joseph. And from a purely human, selfish perspective, you can understand why they didn't tell the truth. I mean, can you imagine the brothers going back to the father and saying, you know what, our bad. You know, Joseph, remember him? Well, I won't be seeing him for a while, or if ever, because, well, we weren't thinking, and we sold him into slavery. We wanted to kill him, but we sold him into slavery. So, sorry about that. Maybe you can have some more kids. No, they didn't. They didn't tell the truth. Didn't even put a spin on the truth. They completely lied about it and made the father believe that a wild animal had killed Joseph. And so they were wrong in what they did to Joseph. They were wrong in the sin against their own father. And you really don't have a sense for their feelings about all of this until you see them before Joseph here after Jacob has passed away. And sometimes we look at this and say, well, they're afraid that father's gone, that Joseph's going to retaliate. That's what they seem to say. But there's a subtext to this that tells you there's been a weight that's been on their minds and in their hearts for all these decades. They have known that what they've done has not been right. If they had thought that way, they'd say at this point, well, now our father has passed away. Let us tell you why we did what we did. We had a good reason for it. And if we just tell you all the facts, in fact, you may not remember these facts, Joseph, but we'll tell you what happened and you believe what we say. No, they didn't do that because they knew they had done wrong. They knew it when they did it that they were doing wrong. They knew it when they lied to their father that they were doing wrong. And that weight of guilt, and I imagine it varied from brother to brother and from time to time, but still in some sense that weight of guilty conscience, it bore into the recesses of their brains ever since they did it. And you can imagine after some days and weeks it turned into some months and some years that if you're one of those brothers, you'd be trying to go to sleep at night and having the sleep not come because you're wondering, well, what happened? What happened to Joseph? And whatever's happened to him, it's my fault. Well, this angst of guilt seems to pour out, mingled with that fear of retribution as they prostrate themselves before Joseph, just as his dream all those years before had portended. But it tells you something in the brothers about people, about life, maybe about us. And that is, as the Bible says, your sin will find you out. Well, that sometimes means the consequence of your actions coming against you in this life. It always means the harvest of seed sown will come to you when life is over. But it almost always means you won't be the same person after you do what you know you shouldn't have. When you've done wrong and you've done as these brothers do, it works at you, plays against you, it takes you over in ways you can't even imagine. I believe in forgiveness because the Bible teaches it. And I believe in forgiveness because I need it. But one thing forgiveness does not do, it doesn't change our own memories of what we've done. You think of the Apostle Paul as a forgiven man, the life he lived before Damascus Road and before Ananias comes to him 3 days later, before his sins are washed away and he becomes a new creature, all things passed away, everything becoming new. His life is turned upside down for the good and he becomes a gospel preacher. And that's what we remember about him. But even toward the end of his life, Paul held in his own mind the memory of what he had done. Because you see, even though he was forgiven for holding the coats of those who stoned Stephen, the scar was still there. And even though he was forgiven for going from house to house and binding Christians and breathing out slaughters and murders against them, the scar of the memory of that was still with him. And that's why he spoke in 1 Corinthians 15 about those who had seen Christ resurrected, James and the apostles, over 500 brethren at once. Last of all, me as well. What about you, Paul? I'm the least. I don't deserve to be called an apostle. I persecuted the church of God. Well, Paul, you've been forgiven for that. Let it go. Well, yes, I believe in forgiveness. And I believe in letting it go. But I also know it's not easy to let it go when you've done wrong and you've caused damage. Damage sometimes that can't be undone. Problems that can't be solved and messes that can't be cleaned up. And even though forgiveness can come, you've got the guilt and the scar, and you do your best to move past it and move on from it. These brothers seem to have that problem themselves. But then we have Joseph. I don't know a whole lot about the psyche or psychological nature of Joseph at 17. I don't know about Joseph when he was sold into slavery, about what he was thinking in his mind. I do know Joseph here seemingly as a very mature and a well-reasoned man and what he's thinking. And he realizes that what's mattered all along is not the way he sees it or how he feels it, but what God desires and what God's doing. And he has learned a long time before this conversation with his brothers. He's learned long before this, whether it's in the pit or in Potiphar's house or in the prison or working with the Egyptian government, he's learned along the way that it's not about him, it's about the will of God. And what matters most is not him. And he's trying to get that across to his brothers. You meant it as evil. And he didn't debate that. That's the case. They did. He knew they did. But basically he's saying, let's let it go. It's past. It's all good. What matters is God intended this to work out for good, and he caused it to work together for good. God is the one who matters, not you, not me, not any of us. That's a hard pill to swallow, but that doesn't make it any less true. And so as the book of Genesis comes to a close, we have a lesson in Joseph from chapter 37 forward that teaches us a great deal about God and about people and perhaps about us. If you're here tonight and outside of Christ, don't leave in that condition. Or if as a Christian you've wandered away and need to come back, don't leave in that condition. If you need to come this evening, come now as together we stand and sing.